The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Sky Broadband. Get the power to do more with Sky's best ever Wi-Fi.
Some time ago, I mentioned an Irish author who had come to our attention in various different ways. But there was a lovely tweet about what he called his library jacket, whereby he thanked his library readers. That's to those of your listeners who've told us about the kindness of his book. Yeah, you know that we love a bit of that sort of thing here. And now Ronan Heshin, his debut novel, Leonard and Hungry Paul, has been named as the Dublin One City One Book Selection for April, which is great news. Ronan, good morning to you. Oh.
Good morning, Ryan.
Nice
thanks for
to
having
talk
me.
To you. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. A beautiful sunny morning here. I'm out in Portmarnock in North County Dublin, so it's lovely.
Okay, well, look, let's see. We'll plough on and see how we're doing delay-wise, and hopefully it'll be grand. I'd love you to do me a favour and give us the rundown of Leonard and Hungry Paul, the synopsis, if you will, so that we can lift off and take our chat from there.
Sure. Well, Leonard and Hungry Paul is a book about gentle people. It's about Leonard, who lives with his mother. He's a man in his early 30s, quite a quiet person. He's a ghostwriter of children's encyclopedias. And early on in the book, so I don't think this is too much of a spoiler, his mother passes away. And that sets off a chain reaction where he has to start really engaging with the world and trying to figure out a way of going out into life without becoming overwhelmed by it. And central to the story is his friendship with his friend Hungry Paul, who is a very sort of self-contained, sort of curious sort of individual who nevertheless has very sort of everyday wisdom about how he lives his life. And the book really centres around their relationship and a sort of family story built around it.
Okay, lovely. And what we'll do is now we're going to call you back, Ronan, and because we couldn't carry on with that delay. So we'll give you a call back, and now that we know what the book's about, we'll continue the chat when we get you back, be it on the phone or otherwise, but we'll have a nice clear go at it then. Let's go back to Ronan. Ronan, are you joining us again?
Morning, Ryan. Hopefully you can hear me better now.
Much better. It could hear you first the first time around. Today was unbearable, so we're here now, which is great. So the book itself is it? I think we'll get into a bit of background from you first, if that's okay, and then we'll launch into the chat about the book. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from.
I'm from Dublin. I'm 45. I'm married, 2 kids. I'm a civil servant by day. And I spent all my life in Dublin. I grew up in Beaumont. My father was a postman. My mother was a hospital cleaner. So I didn't have a particularly literary background. But I think my main background then is I went into music. So the last 20 years or so, I was very involved in the music scene before getting into writing, writing Leonard and Hungry Paul.
Without planning it, there's a theme today about dads and their sons, and like whether it's Russell Crowe talking about his elderly father dying, whether it's Ross talking about his young father dying. In your case, again, if you don't mind me bringing it up, I mean, you were very young when your father passed away.
Yeah, I was 7. So he died in 1983. So I was 7 at the time. I was 1 of 8 children. So my youngest brother was 5, my eldest brother was 19 at the time. So that was a very sort of disruptive part of my life. But I should say that, you know, I think the younger kids were largely protected by it, I think by my mother and my older brothers and sisters. So I think to some extent we were sort of cushioned from the effect of it. But the effects play out throughout your life, I think.
He was a postman. Can I ask you how he died?
He died of a heart attack.
Okay.
So he just died that night unexpectedly.
I understand. And that was left then to your mother to run the show, as it were.
Yeah, well, she was a housewife, a stay-at-home mother at the time of the 8 children. So it was a very big change in her life. So she started work. She worked as a cleaner at Chirstwick Nights in Jervis Street Hospital, which is now the Jervis Shopping Centre in Dublin, and then out to Beaumont. But yeah, she held everything together, and my older brothers as well, who would have been just coming into the working world at that stage.
And I noticed in your book that there is a lot of value placed on kindness and friendship, but also a sense that the introvert has feelings too.
Oh, absolutely. I think the book is really a celebration of quiet and introverted people and kind people, you know, the kind of people who don't often feature prominently, I think, in fiction, because perhaps people are used to stories that are built around drama and conflict. So quieter people tend not to get a focus. And, you know, from an early stage in my life, I've seen how important kind people are. A lot of kindness, I think, is expressed in private, so it's probably overlooked or underestimated. But just as you see, listening to Ronan and Breach there on your show before I came on, they're exactly the kind of people who sort of inspired me throughout my life and, you know, the people I kind of wanted to pay tribute to, really, in the book.
You know, a teacher was on to us, Ronan, not too long ago, saying that in a class of 30, he was always fascinated by the mid-table students, the person who would come 14th out of 30 or 15th out of 30, perfectly adjusted, smart people, but who were at neither end, if you like, of the spectrum, be it personality-wise or education-wise. And he was intrigued by this mid-table bunch of people. But even calling them mid-table to me feels pejorative. But is this the kind of the type of thing you're talking about?
I think the people who interested me, I think, are the kind of people you could easily overlook in life. They don't particularly stand out. They're not particularly pushy. They're not particularly quiet people. Like, we know what loud people think because they tell us. And perhaps the world is the way it is because those people are quite prominent. So I became quite interested in, well, what do the people we're not listening to, what do they have to say? How do I understand these people? And of course, I have elements of it in myself. And once you become aware of it, you see it everywhere. And I began to understand a bit more about how they work. And what occurred to me was, the more I see it in society, what kind people do is they just find something small they can do and they offer it to other people. Like, there was, when I was writing the book, I remember seeing a story on the news about, you know, the homeless people congregate at the GPO to get various homelessness services.
Yes.
And there was a man who would go down there, he was a dental technician. And what he would do is he'd take the impression of the gums of anyone who needed dental help and come back a week later with dentures for them. So there's an example of somebody who doesn't have the answer to the homelessness problem. He doesn't necessarily want to make a political point about it. But there's something he can do that other people can't, and he offers it to other people. And that's what kind people do.
Yeah. Why are we so taken by that notion that you wanted to write and make it such an essential part of your book, kindness?
I think, you know, at a time when so much is changing, it's really easy to overlook what's not changing and what sort of holds everything together. And when I started to think about what are the things that never go away, what are the things that are always prominent, what are the things that throughout the ages have been sort of emphasized as important parts of the individual or holding a society together, and what does my own experience tell me of that? And I began to see kindness is actually really important. I think sometimes people think that perhaps it's an easy word to say and that it's perhaps seen as a feel-good concept, but it's actually a practice. You know, it's not just an idea. It's a thing people do. It's a practical thing that people do. And interesting, I think the one thing I noticed about kind people, actually, is they're always in denial about it. If you say to them, "That's you're very kind to do that," they'll always say, "Sure, what else would I do?" You know, it hardly occurs to them. It's just so innate. And they don't really think that it's anything special, but if you receive it, you see it's valued.
There's part of your story peppered throughout the book. In you know, Hungry Paul is an occasional postman. Leonard is, well, he's actually, I love his job as a ghostwriter for Children's Encyclopedia. That's just a beautifully bonkers job description.
Yeah, well, I suppose I think, to be honest with you, the whole book probably, the style of it comes largely from having spent 10 years reading children's books with my kids. And I think sometimes the friendship is sort of that sort of style. And when I sat down to bash out the book, and bear in mind, you know, when you sit down to write your debut book on a laptop on your kitchen table, you don't think you're going to be talking to Ryan Tuberty about it in 3 years' time. So you're just using what's around you. And I'm surrounded by board games, surrounded by children's encyclopedias. And one thing about children's books is you reread them a lot. So over time, you notice, actually, whoever writes this is pretty good. Look at the way they've done it. Look how creative it is. And yet they're nowhere. So So I thought it was a good occupational choice for a character who's kind of more of a background character, but nevertheless someone of value.
Yeah, no, I love that. They play Yahtzee, they watch University Challenge. How would you describe them, the two lads? I mean, have they stunted growth emotionally, or are they just dancing to their own beat? How would you describe them?
I wouldn't describe them as in any way sort of deficient or in any way people who have shortcomings. Mm-hmm. I think they are people who are self-taught. I think they're self-taught not just in terms of their curiosities, but also their emotional lives. So they tried to figure out the world on their own. They haven't been guided. And so the answers they come up with are a little idiosyncratic. But I do think they're sincere and they're pure. And I think one thing that happens with Hungry Paul, who's a really sort of different type of character in the book, is I think throughout the book, each of the characters goes through change. I think with Hungry Paul, perhaps the reader goes through the change. Mm. You know, if you said to somebody, I want you to meet this guy, you're looking for a boyfriend, I want you to meet this guy, he's early 30s, lives with his parents, only works one day a week. Most people would say, you know what, you're okay. Mm. I think I know who you're talking about. And it's about the way we can sometimes underestimate people from a distance or from appearances, but actually we find out he's a person of great self-awareness.
Yeah. Yeah, you have me really thinking because I just feel sometimes people are, you know, whether it's at a meeting or in company, people could be like Tommy guns, you know, like da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And then the quieter person can, in one, he's like a sniper, or she's like a sniper, where they just go, you know what, cut through all that noise from the noisy, loud person, and feel quite autobiographical here, and I'll be honest with you. And the sniper will just go and make a brilliant point, or it could be a comedy moment, and everyone's left going, where were you for the last 20 minutes? That was amazing. So astute, so funny, so insightful. But not feeling the need to that the whole time. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I absolutely understand that. I think particularly Irish people like to fill silences. I think certainly in social situations.
Yes.
And I noticed that if I'm in meetings or, you know, you're traveling, the Irish person will try and, in a social way, in a positive way. But there's also a benefit to saying, maybe I'll just let things settle.
Mm.
And it'll be clearer then. It's like a muddy glass of water. The only way to clear a muddy glass of water is to let it sit. And then the sediment will go to the bottom and you'll be able to see through it. Mm. And I think people like Leonard and Hungry Paul are of that type. So they suffer from self-doubt because they see the Tommy gun people. And they say, well, you know, they seem to know what they're talking about. Mm. And so often that's the way in life.
Yeah. You know, even though they're spoofing. Yes, go on. Yeah.
Well, this is it. And then, so we don't sort of turn around and ask the person who's, you know, there isn't a way in our sort of noisy world of saying, okay, now let's get a report from the person we haven't heard from in 2 years. What do they make of all this?
Yeah.
But it's one of the things about opinions as well. I think that you can sometimes try and understand an issue up until you have an opinion. And then once you have that, you stop trying to understand it and you switch to trying to defend your opinion. So there's a lot to be said for, you know, keeping a thing open for a while to see how it settles down. And then it takes actually less mental effort because it's just clearer. It just becomes clear, time clear thing.
I agree. I think one of the reasons this book has resonated so much around the place is because it feels like a victory for the quiet man and woman that their story is being told, albeit in fiction, but there's so much truth within that. Tell me what this expression means, that neither has a eureka face. Neither Leonard or Paul, Hungry Paul.
Yeah, they don't have a eureka face. So what that means, and that goes back to a reference of Leonard was quite, he was one of those mid-table people in school, I guess. He didn't get in trouble. Mm. But his teacher said they found it hard to get through to him. And his mother at the parent-teacher meeting says he just lacked a eureka face. In other words, he didn't give the teacher the feedback.
Oh, okay.
So he doesn't have, his face doesn't brighten up when a point registers. He just kind of says, okay, I get it.
Yeah.
So he's just not that particularly demonstrative. So it's probably a hint towards the fact that in the way Leonard interacts, he doesn't always give off the signals that people expect. And so not only is he confused, but so is the other person.
Yeah, I hear you. Oh, that business of the kindness, I'm really struck by that. I don't know, can you learn kindness? I wonder.
I think you can practice it. and I think I'm not a naturally kind person. My wife is a kind person.
I'm sure she would differ with that, but go on.
So there's an element of fake it till you can make it in terms of kindness. if you ideally the starting point is your intention. And one thing that the book talks about and that I try in my own life is feeding birds. I heard you talking about crows who are fantastic. You know, there's something about feeding birds that just starts off a habit of kindness because they never say thank you. You know, they're not going to leave you some flowers.
It's not transactional, is it?
No, and they will come and they will still soil the area and they will still fight over it. And everything. So it's something you can do that is that even though it's unrequited, it's not unrewarding.
Mm.
So if anyone, you know, if there's any evil supervillains listening here and think of changing their ways as a first step before you sort of disarm all your nuclear weapons, first step is get a bird feeder, I think.
Get a bird feeder.
And a daily practice of that will start a chain reaction, I think.
I was presenting the Late Late Show on Friday night, and we ran a little clip of a story about a girl called Quiva who died of cancer. And it was one of those rare enough times, but I kind of find myself deeply affected by it. And I was upset by it, by the story. And also there was an atmosphere in the studio that was very emotional. And you know, you think about your own family and things like that, and good fortune and sadness for others and so on. And after we went to an ad break or whatever, I was gathering myself, and one of my colleagues who works in a part of the area called staging came over, and he was very discreet. He was fixing something near my chair, and I was kind of looking down, just trying to regroup. And he looked up and he said, "You all right?" And I said, "I'm fine. Yeah." He said, "You know," he said, "I've got two girls too. It's not easy." And what I'm trying to say, Ronan, is that it really helped in that little moment because I felt quite exposed, and it was pure kindness what he did there.
Yeah, and I think that often I find in my life that the people who are like that and who have that awareness are people who've lived it or who've received kindness. So that person, I'm sure in their lives, has had people who've looked out for them, and so it does kind of become slightly contagious. And I don't mean that in any sort of trite way.
No.
But once you recognize its value and have experienced it as experiential, it sort of reprograms you a little bit. You know, you realize the value of it and the value of doing it. Because I often sometimes, you know, when it's a funeral and you think, I don't really know the person, should I go? You know what I mean? Do I know them well enough? And then if you lose somebody in your life and you're at a funeral and you see people, like, for example, you asked me about my father.
Hmm.
My father died in 1983. My mother died in 2007. People who worked at my father showed up at my mother's funeral. You know, that's 24 years later.
Yeah.
After that, I said, okay, every time I'm the question of whether I should go to a funeral or removal, I'll always go. You know, and it's because that little interaction just teaches you the value of it.
And then it becomes hereditary. I mean, you think of your young Dahi saying that his auntie's cat was sick, so I'm going to give her part of my prize yesterday. You think of, you know, talking earlier on to Ross and he's raising funds. Kindness can be hereditary. And we kind of went off the beaten track a little bit, but that was entirely my fault. Your book is just superb and congratulations on it. I'm delighted that it was chosen, I should say, for the one Dublin One City One book for April. And I think everyone listening today will really thoroughly enjoy new, wonderful Irish writing. So welcome to that wonderful world, Ronan. Congratulations to you, and fair play to your kids for letting you ruin their day on a daily basis by stealing ideas like a magpie or indeed a raven from their table. But no, well done to you. Fair play.
Thanks so much, Ryan.
Nice talking to you. We'll do it again sometime. Ronan Heshen is the author of Leonard and Hungry Paul. That's the book you need to get from your local bookshop if you can do it, even better. And we appreciate his time this morning. We have a competition to get to in a minute.